Before I actually bring up the slides, first thing, I'd like to thank you very much for the invitation to speak here. It's been a great conference, and I'm really happy to be here, so thank you. Before I bring up the slides, I'd like to, for those of you who have devices, there'll be a couple definitions and some diagrams that it might be useful for you to be able to consult while they're not actually up on the screen. So. That's my website, bwestlake.org, and the slides are available right here. So if you have a computer and you'd like to grab those and consult them, please do. I'll assume that you're not doing anything else on your computer, but paying attention to my talk. Okay. Okay. So the question is posed very generally, the question in the title, but actually, as you'll see, I'm only interested in addressing one little variety of this type of question you can ask about causation. The main sort of take-home message I want you to have is that there are actually lots and lots of different questions in this territory. And I'd like you to appreciate the range of these questions and the different kinds of answers that might be available for these questions. I'll try to address one particular question. What I have to say about it will get increasingly schematic as I go along. And I anticipate that you will all have a lot to say about it. I hope that you will. And I think that there'll be plenty of room at the end for questions. So I look forward to them. So here's the aim of the talk. What I'd like to do is, as I said, to identify a question, a particular question concerning the function of the concept of actual causation. And as I said, to sketch an answer to that particular question. And the plan is to proceed as follows. First of all, I'll start by distinguishing what I'll call functional questions. You can ask about causal concepts from other questions you can ask about them. Second of all, to describe a framework for thinking about causal concepts, which I'll just assume and not argue for, but it will help to frame the issues I want to talk about. Third of all, I want to distinguish four different functional questions you can ask about causation. And for three of these, I'm just going to sort of indicate the direction in which I think answers can be found. I won't sort of engage in a sustained defense for those three, but then I want to look more closely at the fourth one that I'll raise and present, as I said, an outline of an answer to that particular question. And I think the question I'm addressing is very closely related or a different aspect of a question that Chris will address in the next talk. And from what I can guess he's going to say, I think what I'll have to say will be complementary. They will be Both might be true, I think, but we'll see what he has to say about that. So I'll finish by sketching my answer to that question, as I said. So let me start with the distinction between functional and other questions you might ask about causal concepts. So here are three different kinds of questions you can ask about a particular concept of philosophical interest. One question you can ask is a traditional one, is, what's the nature of the concept? For example, does it have an analysis in terms of other concepts? Second kind of question you can ask about a concept concerns the corresponding aspect of the world. So you can ask, what's the nature of the property, say, or the relation that the concept picks out? A third kind of question, and these are the kinds of questions that I'm going to be interested in addressing, is one way of putting these questions is, what is the point of possessing such a concept? And in particular, one way of formulating such questions is to ask, what's the point of possessing the concept rather than, or in addition to, possessing various other concepts that are very closely related to it? The kinds of concepts, for example, that philosophers have traditionally tried to use to analyze the concept in question. And when I ask what the point is, I mean not to be asking the kind of evolutionary question, you know, how did the concept evolve, but rather what practical purpose or goal that we actually possess now would be served by possessing a concept of this kind. So for example, you can ask these kinds of questions about the concept of knowledge. So you can ask, what's the nature of the concept of knowledge? Does it have an analysis? Can it be analyzed, for example, in terms of justification and truth and belief, reliability, and so on? But a very different kind of question you can ask about knowledge is, what's the nature of knowledge? For example, Tim Williamson asks, or he defends the thesis that knowledge is a kind of mental state, and I understand that thesis as a thesis about what knowledge is. It's not necessarily something that can be produced by analysis. And a third kind of question is the question, what's the point of possessing the concept of knowledge? And in particular, what's the point of possessing a concept of knowledge in addition to possessing concepts of justification and truth and belief and reliability and so on? And philosophers have tried to answer that question in the case of knowledge. So, for example, Edward Craig has a book defending the view that knowledge is, the point of the concept of knowledge is to discriminate between reliable and unreliable testifiers or informants. So in the case of causation, all three questions arise as well. They arise for different causal concepts that we'll have, and what I'd like to do is ask this third functional question about our causal concepts. I want to ask, what's the point of possessing such a concept in addition to or rather than various closely related concepts that we might have or do have? Okay. So let me present the framework within which I'll work. I'll try to say just enough to say the things I want to say later. So I'm just going to assume the following things without arguing for them, although I think that the framework is a useful and important one to use, partly because it's so philosophically fruitful, and partly because there's some empirical evidence that people actually employ concepts like the ones that the framework involves. So, first assumption, the world has an objective counterfactual structure which can be represented by causal models. And I'll say a little bit more about what causal models are when I get to the next slide, but to a first approximation, a causal model is consists in a set of variables which can take different values, and the possible values for variables represent, let's assume, possible events. And a model also contains a set of equations which specify relationships of counterfactual dependency between the values of the variables. I'll say a little bit more about that on the next slide, as I said. I'm going to assume that there's a notion of model appropriateness, that is, and I'll understand that in the following way. This is deliberately very uninformative, because there's a very big question about what makes a causal model appropriate for the situation that it represents, and I want to remain pretty neutral about how to spell out the notion, but I'll assume that there is a question of what makes a model appropriate. I'll say it's appropriate if and only if it includes variables and values that are appropriate for the situation that it's being used to represent, and it accurately represents the counterfactual structure of the situation. And here's a crucial feature of models that will be relevant to some of what I say later. Causal models are typically partial representations in the following two senses. So the first sense is a model will omit certain variables that appear in other appropriate models for the very situation in question, in effect treating the actual values of those variables as part of the fixed background. And second of all, the second way in which a model can be partial is that a given variable may lack values, possible values that another model has, in effect treating the corresponding possibility, the corresponding possible event for that value as irrelevant, as an irrelevant thing to represent concerning the situation in question. So for example, here's a situation and the corresponding causal model. So let me first of all tell you about the situation, then tell you about the model. So the situation is a simple one. There's a lamp that can either be on or off, and the lamp is controlled by three switches. Each switch can be in one of three positions. So I haven't represented that actually up here. The way that the illumination of the lamp depends on the switches is that the lamp will be illuminated just in case any two of the switches are in the same position, and it will be unilluminated otherwise, right? So if the switches are all in different positions, the lamp is off. If two of them are in the same position, then the lamp is on. Okay, in the actual situation that I'm interested in, So there's three switches, I'm calling them A, B, and C. The switches B and C are in the same position, and switch A is in a different position. And I'm now switching to the model. I'm using variables A, B, and C to refer to the switches, and they can take three possible values, minus 1, 0, and 1, just representing the three possible switches, positions for the switches in each case. And the structural equation that tells you how the illumination of the lamp counterfactually depends on the position of the switches is specified by L, which tells you that the lamp would be on if two are in the same position, it would be off otherwise. What the arrows, so just to emphasize, this is not a neuron diagram, this is a directed graph representation of a causal model. What the arrows mean is that there's some state of the system where a state consists in a specification of just which particular events obtain in the situation. So there's some possible state of the situation such that variation in the upstream variable would lead to a variation in the downstream variable, right? So that's the conditions under which you get an arrow between two variables in the model. There's some state of the model such that changing the upstream one would change the downstream one. Okay, so this is a partial model of the situation, right? It emits variables that represent the way that the switch is actually constructed, right? It just tells you about the pattern of counterfactual dependence between the position of the switches and the illumination of the lamp. And it's also partial in the second sense that I introduced. There are possible things that could happen to the switches that this model doesn't inform you about, right? So what happens if you destroy one of the switches? What happens to the lamp? This model doesn't tell you, right? So there are certain possibilities that are just treated as irrelevant in this particular situation. Okay, so in telling you the counterfactual structure of this situation, I've told you everything relevant there is to know about what would happen if you wiggled those switches in any which way compatible with the model being capable of representing that contingency. So you know everything there is that's relevant to prediction and control, also explanation, I think. And yet there's a further distinction we make among the switches in this particular case, or at least so I submit. I submit that in this particular situation, the position of switches B and C are a cause of the lamp being on and the position of switch A is not. Position of switch A made no difference to the illumination of the lamp, given that B and C were both in the same position. If you can test that intuition, then I'll have more to say about it later on. Okay. So here's an initially attractive thesis about the relationship between this notion of, so this further notion of actual causation, a sifting of which particular events were the actual causes of a particular effect. There's an attractive thesis about the relation of that notion, the notion of actual causation, to the particular counterfactual structure. And the attractive thesis is that the facts concerning actual causation are grounded in facts concerning counterfactual structure. So the task of the philosopher is to construct the recipe for taking you from a model to the facts concerning which of those variables represent the actual causes. And there are different proposals for what that mapping is that have been given by Chris and Jim and Halpin and Pearl, just among others. And they disagree about what the mapping is. And as we'll see, I disagree with all three of those proposals also. And the second thing I want to say about actual causation is that the very idea that there exists such a mapping from the facts about the appropriate model to the facts about actual causation has recently come under attack from people who've claimed that you can have two appropriate models for two different situations, which nevertheless differ concerning which of the variable values represent the actual causes in those situations. And if that's right, then there can't be a rule that just takes you, without knowing what the particular model represents, a rule that takes you from facts about counterfactual structure to facts about what the actual causes are. And other people have replied that these alleged counterexamples involve models that are not apt. I should say all the references that I have here are in the final slides if you want to grab the PDF. For my purposes, I don't want to try and adjudicate between these this thesis about whether the actual causal facts are wholly determined by the structure, counterfactual structure of the situation. I just want to note that the concept of actual causation is a distinct concept from the concept of counterfactual structure. In the sense that you could possess all of the concepts required to grasp the counterfactual structure of the situation, but lack the concept of actual causation. Okay. So what I want to now do is to distinguish between these four different questions you might ask about causation from the perspective of this particular framework. I'll try to run through the first three relatively quickly. So here's a first question you might ask, and it concerns the kind of counterfactual structure that the causal models are being used to represent. So the question is this: why is it this particular counterfactual structure that's relevant to the concept of causation? And I think the force of this question can be seen most easily from the perspective of a possible world semantics for counterfactuals. So roughly, we say that if P were the case, Q would be the case as true at a world W, if and only if Q is true in all the closest P worlds to W. The P worlds are worlds where P is true. Thus, on this way of understanding counterfactuals, whether a certain counterfactual is true depends on the way in which we order worlds in terms of similarity and difference. That is, it depends on the similarity metric that orders these possible worlds. Now, the similarity metric that's relevant to the concept of causation, as became clear from early criticisms of the simple counterfactual theory of causation, is distinct from two other metrics, one concerning the metric responsible for intuitive judgments of which worlds are most similar to which others. And it's also distinct, it turns out, from the similarity metric responsible for at least some of our ordinary counterfactual judgments. So actually, I think Helen was using one of these backtrackers earlier when she was saying that if she hadn't been in pain, the toenail wouldn't have fallen off her foot. Now, that seemed kind of natural, but it's because we're thinking, well, if she hadn't been in pain, she wouldn't have kicked her foot, and therefore the toenail wouldn't have fallen off. But that's reasoning from an effect back to a cause and then back out to an effect. Those can't be the ones that are responsible for causal judgments. Those are two actual metrics that are employed in our judgments that aren't the same as the metric we use for causal judgment. And more generally, I mean, you can come up with any arbitrary similarity metric you please to validate whatever counterfactual judgment you like, thus raising the question, what's so special about the particular one that we employ when we represent a kind of counterfactual relevant to the analysis of causation? And here's a recipe for an answer. It's something about the relationship between that particular counterfactual structure and the notion of an intervention. I'm not going to say anything more than that, but that's a research program. That's not the question I want to address, though, today. I want to distinguish that question from the one I'm interested in. Likewise, I want to distinguish a different question you can ask from the one I'm interested in. This question is the question, this is a more familiar question in the history of theorizing about causation. What's the point of possessing causal concepts in addition to correlational concepts? And again, appeal to something like the notion of an intervention as a sort of traditional way of replying to this. So as Nancy Cartwright said, concept of causation can discriminate amongst the kinds of correlations that underwrite effective strategies and the kinds of correlations that don't underwrite effective strategies. Now, you can endorse that answer to this question without endorsing a view that Dummett defended, which is that if you couldn't actually act in the world, you wouldn't actually develop the concept of causation. That's a distinct thesis. And you don't have to try to analyze the notion of causation in terms of effective strategies or interventions. You're just saying that the point of possessing the causal concept is that possessing it enables you to make inferences about interventions. And there's a nice generalization of this idea that Chris has given, where he defends a more general claim that the role of the concept of causation is not merely to sort of facilitate these inferences between correlations and interventions, but more generally to facilitate inferences between correlations and counterfactuals and mechanisms as well. So maybe the inferential role is slightly more complex than answering this particular question requires. Okay, third question, the question of causal selection. So within the particular framework, I'm assuming, there's actually two kinds of questions here. Maybe they end up collapsing, but on the face of it, there are two kinds of questions. You can say, why do we tend to select one particular causal model? As I said, there are typically many appropriate causal models for a given situation. Why do we tend to employ one of them to represent the situation and not others? And a second kind of question that could arise is, given that they're relative to a particular causal model, there might be many actual causes, why do we pick out some of those and call those ones the causes and neglect others? And there are actually two kinds of questions you might ask about this. First, why do we engage in causal selection at all? That's a question. But then a second question is a more specific question. Why do we select in the particular way we do? So why do we pick out the particular causes that we pick out? And there's different things you could say about this. So for example, Lewis, I think, is just a pure pragmatist about this. He doesn't, in the sense that he thinks it's all just general pragmatics. He doesn't think that there's anything interesting you can say in general about why we prefer certain kinds of causes to other kinds of causes. At least early Lewis, maybe the influence Lewis, has a slightly different view about this, but I think this is especially clear in the Lewis paper on causal explanation, where he says to explain, as Helen told us earlier, to provide some information about causal history, and to the question, well, which information, he says it's all equally good, just general pragmatic principles determine which particular parts of the causal history you're interested in. I think that can't be right, and I think that is that there are context-independent principles, defeasible ones, that govern the kinds of causal relations that we tend to be interested in, the kinds of causes, actual causes that we tend to pick out. And two candidates for such principles are one that we heard about earlier today, the idea of insensitive causal relations or stable causal relations. That is, these are causal relations that couldn't easily have failed to obtain. So they're sort of robust across possible variations to the actual situation. And a second kind of principle that I think governs selection of causes is a principle I call abstraction, which is that if we've got a choice between two causes and they satisfy a kind of supervenience relationship, so whenever the one obtains, the other cause is also a cause, given the background circumstances, but not the other way around, we prefer the more general cause. Not because the lower level one or the one that subvenes is not a cause, but because the higher level one is more general. So this is a sort of robustness, not across variations to the nearby variations to the actual situation, but across all possible ways that things could be. Well, why do we select in those particular ways, if I'm right that we do? There's two, actually, I want to say three possible answers you could give to that. One is that these kinds of generality conditions on causes make for good explanations, and we care about causal explanation. Another one is that we care about models that are portable in the sense that it's, very fragile causal relations are ones that are sort of unlikely to obtain again. And so you're going to have to construct a new model to represent a new situation. Whereas if you're representing a situation using the kinds of causal relations that appear over and over again, you've got a sort of general purpose representational tool. So there's a sort of practical relevance to representing the more general and insensitive causal relations. Again, that's a suggestion for an answer. I'll say more about this one. This is the one I'm interested in. So I want to emphasize that it's a different question to those other three. This is the question, as I said before, why possess this additional concept of actual causation in addition to the concepts required to grasp causal models? So that's the question, why possess any further concept? And second of all, given that there have been all of these competing accounts of what actual causation is, why do we pick out the particular kind of counterfactual dependence that we do? That is, why possess this particular concept, given the range of alternatives that have been made salient by theorizing about the relation? Okay. So here's where I start to get a little bit sketchy. I don't think I have the answer. I have a sort of an intuition, I guess, that I think might be promising. But first of all, I want to convince you that we should care about this question. I mean, it's intrinsically interesting, I think, but here are some reasons instrumental reasons to care. One is that you might think, depending on background views you have about the relation between what I call the conceptual, metaphysical, and functional questions, you might actually think that answering the functional question about causation gives you a kind of conceptual analysis of causation. That is, you might think answering the functional question is a way of answering the conceptual question. That is, you might think that the way to specify the nature of a concept is to specify its function. This is something that kind of like an idea that Chris defends in the 2006 paper, and David Danks has suggested a similar idea. So you might think that that's the way to do conceptual analysis, to answer these functional questions. Second role is to, this is the one that I think is really important, or at least for my purposes, is to resolve particular disputes about what the actual causes are in a given situation, and more generally, which theory of actual causation is correct. So as I said, there are competing accounts of what it is, and the arguments tend to trade on differing intuitions. And so, you know, I say those two switches are causes, but the third one isn't. And other people say, no, the third switch is also a cause. If the only tool at our disposal is to trade intuitions, then we've sort of, it's game over at that point if our intuitions don't align. The idea is maybe if I can defend my theory on grounds that I can explain why we would possess a concept on which we should only pick out those two switches and not the third, I can sort of have an additional justification for my theory over my opponent. And more generally, I think answering the functional question at least potentially provides an answer to a kind of general skepticism about the use and appeal to intuitions in theorizing about actual causation. So the CMU crowd, there's about 10 people on this paper, defend general skepticism about the use of hypothetical examples like the switch example and adjudicating theories of actual causation based on our intuitions about these cases, roughly on grounds that we can only survey a tiny fraction of the total number of cases, so why believe that our intuitions are gonna reliably extend to all of the various complicated cases that we can consider? Well, maybe answering the functional question will give us something more principled to say about why we should believe a particular theory. And I just added this one yesterday. An answer to the functional question might give you a reason to argue against the thesis that Sarah defended yesterday about, you know, she was saying we shouldn't care about the distinction between actual and possible causation. Well, maybe there's a kind of answer to the functional question that's distinct from the one she considered that provides a justification for caring about the notion. Okay, so why bother with actual causation? So let me give you a particular argument over intuitions about a case that I'm interested in. So the lamp light switch, the lamp switch example is my example, and Joe Halpin says that third switch that doesn't match the first two is not a cause. Is a cause. I say it's not a cause. He says it is a cause in this situation. He says, look, imagine that the situation, I'm going to fill in some more variables and tell you how the lamp actually works, and the lamp actually works like this, let's suppose. And this is, it's a possible implementation of the mechanisms that make true the counterfactuals that I specified earlier. Works like this. There are these three detectors between the switches and the lamp, and they're not detectors in the sense that that first one, detector N minus 1, lights up if none of the switches are in position minus 1. The second one, N0, lights up if none of the switches are in position 0, and likewise for N1. And so Halpern says, look, if the lamp is built like this, the path between the position of the switches and the lamp being illuminated in the situation I described, that is where the switches B and C are in position minus 1 and switch A is in position 1, it goes like this. The not zero detector lights up, and the reason that not zero detector is lighting up is due to the position of all three switches, because they all need to be not in position zero for that not zero detector to light up, and that in turn causes the lamp to be on. Hence, by transitivity, one argument you might give, or maybe just bare appeal to intuition. Look, if the lamp is built like that, then it turns out that that third switch really was an actual cause of the lamp going on after all. Now, I deny that, and I have a theory which entails that you ought to deny that, and Halpern accepts it and has a theory on which you ought to accept it, and so the idea is, well, I'm going to tell a functional story about why you should like my theory and not Halpern's theory. There's my theory. This is why you should really care about having other ways to distinguish theories from one another besides the appeal to intuitions, I think. In my defense, there's only two extra conditions in this theory with respect to Halpern's theory. So this is a necessary condition for actual causation, and it's conditions strand and diff that are just tacked on to Halpern and Perl's theory. So sort of in defense of the complexity of this, it's only two more epicycles on another theory that people have taken seriously. So, you know, any Ptolemaic astronomer could have said that, I suppose. Let me say something about what these conditions say. So the first big conjunction of conditions, it defines a notion of a variable value being an actual cause of another variable value relative to a model, and the final condition derelativizes it by saying something is an actual cause implicit or just in case there's an appropriate model in which it's represented as an actual cause. First condition is straightforward. The something is a cause of an effect only if both cause and effect occur, right? So the variables have to take those values. The second condition I should unpack a little bit by telling you what I mean by a minimally sufficient sequence. So you can define a notion of sufficiency within causal models in counterfactual terms as follows. A set of values for variables is sufficient for the value of some target variable, just in case, no matter what you do to the other variables in the model, the target variable would retain its value. And then you can define a notion of minimal sufficiency in the obvious way. You say no subset of that collection of variables satisfies that same condition. And then you can define the notion of a sequence of such conditions by starting from the target variable value and working your way back. So take a particular variable value, take minimally sufficient variable values immediately upstream, then take minimally sufficient sets of variable values again and work your way backwards. I say if you're not a member of a path that travels through such a set of minimally sufficient conditions, then you're not a cause. The third condition is a sort of difference-making condition, and this one is in Halpern and Perl. This one says there is a path from the cause to the effect such that there's a way of changing the variables elsewhere in the model such that you get counterfactual dependence between the cause and the effect. And the different theories, Jim and Chris's and Halpern and Perl's theory, they disagree on what the permissible ways you can change the model so as to reveal that counterfactual dependence is, and it sounds like Paul and collaborators have a recipe for doing this as well, which I need to look at. The fourth condition is a difference-making condition in a different sense. This condition says that in the state of the model produced by setting the cause variable to the alternative value that reveals the effect, it can't be the case that all of those earlier conditions are satisfied for the alternative value for the cause with respect to the effect. So I'll say a little bit more about this condition in what follows. Okay, so that's a complicated theory. I have a paper where I argue that it gets all our intuitions right for a bunch of cases that make problems for the other theories. But as I said here, what I want to do is try and say, why would we have a concept that looks like that? It's a good question. I hope you'll agree. Okay, so here's the sort of guiding intuition. The guiding intuition is that the point of possessing a concept like that is to identify actual variable values that would have been suitable targets of interventions designed to ensure, that in the sense of guarantee, an effect on the assumption that all possible combinations of variable values are genuine ways things might have been absent those interventions, right? So the causes are the things that would have been suitable things to do in order to ensure an effect occurs in a situation in which you don't know which ways all of the various possibilities represented by the model are. Now, I'll try and spell that out a little bit. Now, Chris has argued in a forthcoming paper that for purposes of decision, if you're a causal decision theorist, you don't need to appeal to the notion of actual causation in order to give a justifiable decision theory, and concludes from this that we don't need the concept of actual causation for prospective deliberation. Now, I agree with what Chris argues in that paper, but the argument in the paper assumes that at the time of decision, we know what the actual values of all of the variables in the model are, and we're just trying to decide whether we should intervene on a particular variable in question. And I agree that counterfactual dependence is good enough in that circumstance. I'm suggesting that the notion of actual causation is useful in a context, well, it's not that it's useful in a context where you're actually making a decision, but we employ it to sort of, as it were, think about hypothetical prospective deliberation concerning a sequence that actually happened, asking ourselves what would have been good things to do if we didn't know what the actual values of the variables would be in such a circumstance. So I think the present proposal is compatible with what Chris says in that paper. Okay, so what I want to do now is just run quickly through the sort of try and say something about how this sort of general intuition would play out with respect to the different conditions that I said I think are necessary conditions on actual causation. So why care about minimally sufficient sets? Well, we care about sufficient sets because we wish to ensure that outcomes occur, and we care about minimally sufficient sets because there's no point acting if your action is not required. So we want there to be a sufficient condition, but we want our action to sort of be required for the sufficient condition. Otherwise, if we have independent reasons for thinking there's some other sufficient condition, no point acting. Okay, why do we care about difference making under non-actual contingencies, right? So as I said, that path condition says what's required for causation is not counterfactual dependence, but rather, if you will, counterfactual dependence under some possible contingency, right? So we say there needs to be counterfactual dependence of the following kind. Is there an alternative state, a permissible alternative state of the model such that you get counterfactual dependence? Well, why care about that? And the question is probably put more clearly than I just put it in this quote. What purpose can be served by identifying factors that would have made a difference, not in the actual situation, but in a modified version of the actual situation? Well, as I said, we care about difference making because we care about being required to ensure the outcome. And what I want to say is we care about difference making under non-actual contingencies because at the time of action, we're typically not certain which contingencies will be actual. So when we're projecting back, even though there's a fact of the matter about which contingencies are actual, when we're making decisions, we don't know which ones are actual. So what we care about is the chance of making a difference under some relevant contingency, not whether we in fact, make a difference. Different way to put that is to say that it might be rational to bring about a certain variable value that doesn't turn out to actually make a difference to the effect in the simple counterfactual sense if you didn't know whether the other conditions were going to conspire that way or not. With respect to the diff condition, mostly what I want to do here is defer to some work by Carolina Sartorio, who's she has a series of papers, although this 2013 paper is the one that's most relevant to what I want to say. Really nice papers on the connection between causation and responsibility. And she argues that this condition DM2 here, which is very similar to the difference condition that I give, is a condition on both causation, actual causation, and on responsibility. So the condition says that R is a difference-making relation whenever R relates X to Y. If X had been absent, R would not have related X's absence to Y. Slightly different from what I said, because I said, I didn't talk about absences. She talks about absences, but the conditions are very closely related to one another. And so I want to defer to her arguments for why we should think that about responsibility. Now, she thinks that the reason why responsibility satisfies this condition is because actual causation does. I want to suggest maybe it's the other way around. So maybe there's an independent argument for thinking that you're only responsible for something if you're a relation that if you're related in a way that satisfies DM2 to that thing, and maybe that's the reason that actual causation needs to satisfy the condition. But in either case, the reason we should believe that it's true, that this condition is true, is because of the connection between actual causation and responsibility, I want to say. So mostly I'm deferring to Sartorio on that particular question. So as I said, that was schematic. I've sort of given you the direction in which I want to work towards an answer to the question. Ideally, answering these questions, as I said, would adjudicate between competing theories in a completely principled way. So I'd tell you my functional story, and you'd say, of course, that's the theory we should endorse. I don't pretend to have achieved that today. I've given you a sort of sketch of the kind of functional story I think we should tell. But I've left out certain parts, certain further questions you might ask. So one question is, why care about chains of sufficiency? And I think that Chris is going to answer that for me in the next talk. I hope so. A second question you can ask is, I guess he's going to say, why care about chains? Why care about chains of sufficiency? Second question, why the particular constraints on permissible variable values in the path condition? I hope that there's an answer to that, but I haven't tried to answer it today. And second of all, if the direction of explanation between actual causation and responsibility is the way that I suggested that it goes, that is, we first argue that responsibility is a difference-making relation in this sense, and then argue from that explains why actual causation is. We need an independent argument that responsibility is a relation of that sort, that functional story, right? Why would we have a notion of responsibility that satisfies that relation? So all of that's work to be done. And I want to conclude, I guess, on a final skeptical point. The Carnegie Mellon crowd might say, well, look, this storytelling about what the point is of having a certain concept is just as unprincipled as the construction of theories in response to intuitions. Hence, I'm just as skeptical about arriving at a good theory of actual causation on this basis as I was on the basis of intuitions. And I guess my reply to that is simply that we're not going to know until we actually explore what kinds of justifications can be given for this functional question. And maybe there's more generally maybe we can reach a kind of reflective equilibrium between judgments about cases and answers to the functional questions that overall give us some reason for preferring a particular theory. So I'll finish there. As I said, the references are in the slides if you'd like to get them. Okay, thank you.